Hello and welcome aboard Seascapes, your maritime programme. This week, Norman Freeman, author of Sea Spray and Whiskey, has a maritime tale on the benefits of snakebite. However, first we hear from a marine engineer and seafarer who has sailed the world's oceans. He lived in Australia and wrote about his experiences there. In February of 2008, he was kidnapped by Somali pirates off the coast of Africa, an experience he's writing about. That man is Fred Parle, whom Seascapes met up with this summer in Ross's Point near his home in Sligo. Fred Parle told us about his first interest in the sea.
I was born in Sandy Cove, the other side of Dunleary, and we lived very close to the sea. In fact, there was only, I think there was 11 houses between me and the sea. It was Marine Avenue in Sandy Cove. And nearby, we had the 40 Foot, which was a very famous swimming place. Everybody remembers the quip. Bathing costumes must be worn before 10 a.m. And dogs not allowed. Well, the reason for that was because the gentlemen went around with no bathing costumes before 10 o'clock. The sea was all around me, and I grew up and went to school in Dunleary and eventually went to Monkstown Park. All the time I was involved with the sea. In the summertime, when I was a teenager, I used to dig bait for the fishermen, the gentlemen fishermen. I used to dig ragworm, and I used to cycle from Dunleary all the way across to Clontarf from the far side of the bay. And the Morgan brothers down in the back of Parliament Street used to take all the worms I could dig. So there were happy days, and I was fully employed every summer. In latter years, we used to go to Wexford, down to Bannow Bay. So it was always the sea, the sea, the sea, all the time. So I suppose in a way it was natural that ultimately when I went to think about going, leaving school and getting a job, the sea was pretty well high up in my priorities. Well, sometimes when there'd be two diggings in the day, you know, two low tides in the day, it'd stay there, and I had a long line with about 30 hooks on it, and I used to lay it over the diggings, and I used to notice that the bass used to come in out of the channel, and it nose around in the old diggings, picking up all the bits of worms that you left behind. And you used to catch maybe three or four bass every day. That wasn't very often, but it was a very nice contribution to the family table. It was called salmon bass in those days, and I learned years later that it wasn't a salmon and it wasn't a bass at all. It was actually a perch, a sea perch. But it still tasted good. Inshore, they seemed to grow fairly small, you know, up to about 2.5 pounds weight. But then years later down in Bannow Bay, when I used to see them actually boiling the surface of the water, my old cousin there, Ned Murphy, God rest his soul, taught me how to fish for the bass. And I remember going home one day with a 19.5 pound bass gilled across the bicycle. And that was the biggest one I ever saw, 19.5 pound weight. Dad said to me, he'd just set up Johnson & Johnson's, the pharmaceutical company in Dublin, and he was a man of few words, and he sort of said to me, well, what do you want to do when you leave school? And I said, man, I want to go to sea. I want to become an engineer. So he said, well, I'll ask around. And he asked a friend of his that he knew called, he was a Gillen from Ross's Point. Now, I can't remember which one it was, but he sailed with B&I. And Don, I think, was in Don Gillen. And he asked Don what he thought. And Don, of course, thought this was a great idea. But, of course, he would have liked to see me become a deck apprentice. Anyway, the discussion went round and we all learned a little bit more about seagoing. And ultimately, Dad approached an old friend of his that he worked with in Texaco years ago, a fella called, what was his name now? He asked them about Caltex, if they had any openings at sea. So he found out eventually that Caltex in London, they owned a shipping company called Overseas Tank Ships, and they had apprenticeships which were sponsored by the Department of the Board of Trade, I think it was at the time, no, the Department of Transport, the British Department of Transport, and Ernie Marples was the minister at the time, famous for riding a bicycle around London. Never got a ticket for putting it up against the wall either. He put a word out and came back that Caltex would be interested in interviewing me. So, long story short, Dad and I, we went over on the, I think we went over on the Princess Maud, the old famous steamer from Dunleary, and eventually got to London and had the interview. And ultimately, I got into Caltex and started my apprenticeship with them. And it was a 4.5 year apprenticeship. And it was the quick way to get to sea, because before that, an engineer had to serve his apprenticeship in a shipyard and then either go to sea on the ship that he would help to build, or alternatively go on the open market for a job. I just thought of the man who started it all. His name was Dan Langan. And Dan Langan was quite a famous international rugby player. And himself and my dad used to be on the truck, Caltex truck out of, I think it was Kilkenny was the depot that they worked out of. And Dad was the man who used to clean out the tanks, and Dan was the driver. So years later they met up and got me a job, simple as that. Started off in London, of course, the first time I ever had a Chinese meal, and that was for the interviews. I was interviewed eventually by the principal of Acton Technical College, a fellow called Speak, and he was delighted with the Irish Intermediate Certificate, as shown by my knowledge of mathematics, English and history and so on, and declared that I was of a sufficient level to go and be an apprentice. But subsequently they found out that the inter cert wasn't anything up to the GCE levels at all. And anyway, I was lucky. That's another story. But I went first to Portsmouth for 2 years in a technical college, and we were released at half term then and given a travel warrant for the train and the boat home, and that was about every 10 weeks, and Christmas holidays and so on. Well, that went on for 2 years. The first year we spent the summer holidays in the college learning how to use basic tools and machine shop work and that type of thing, and the second year we were released. We had to go out in the big bad world then, and my choice was Camilleri's shipyard in Birkenhead, and my roommate actually in Portsmouth, Dave McMahon, his family lived in the world in Leeso, and I was lucky enough to be able to get digs with his mother there. So I was in the shipyard for the whole summer, and I saw ships called the Auckland Star was one. I worked on submarine, British submarines there. I worked on the first ever that I know of anyway, gas turbine ship. It was a converted shell tanker called the Aurus, and which was a failure, but it found out an awful lot about gas turbine propulsion. And after that, back to school, and eventually in the second year, the end of the second year, took my exams, and luckily enough, I got a pass, and some of the lads didn't, especially some of the lads that had advanced GCE. Starting, some of them didn't work and didn't pass. So anyway, that was it, home then for Christmas, and then after Christmas I was posted to my first ship, which was the Caltex Sydney, and I was due to join it in Dublin, believe it or not, at the Alexander Basin in Dublin. And the first, what I can really remember even now is the smell of the curry, not the oil down the depot, but as soon as you got to the ship, it was the smell of the curry, because it had Indian crew. The Indian crew were all from Bombay. Well, the catering were from up north, and but all the crew were Lascars from Bombay. So off I went then, apprentice engineer, and who joined me? Only my roommate Dave McMahon, and another fella from Lancashire. So we had three apprentices, and of course it was a great adventure. The seagoing has changed dramatically. Like, I look back on that little 17,000 ton SCA to T2 turbo electric tanker built for one trip across the Atlantic to dodge in German submarines, and lucky to get to England with a cargo of oil. And some of them lasted 30 years ultimately, which was fantastic. They were an amazing little ship, and they had 58 of a crew. 58 of a crew. A 17,000 tonner today, you'd be lucky to have a crew of six. So yes, things have changed. Cargo handling techniques today are all over on containers, and I was reading yesterday and about the latest Maersk container ships, which are enormous vessels and highly automated, the biggest in the world, and carry an incredible number of containers, which can be discharged very, very quickly. Well, I remember the only place I know about containers was Port Botany, just south of Sydney, and I watched container operations there and in Singapore, and boy, they really can whip them out and whip them in again. And yes, they have a huge, very quick turnaround, and there's no time for any. Everybody's employed full time, and they don't have time to go ashore. Out of sight, out of mind. That's the expression that comes to mind for me, because the whilst seafarers, British seafarers, Irish seafarers, are represented fairly well by their unions, once they leave the shores and travel and work overseas, they're normally forgotten about. In the old days, there were people who never came home. They sat their licenses, their tickets in Bombay, in Calcutta, in Hong Kong, even in Singapore. And that was in the days when there was a big British presence there. But the ships, the people never came home. They just stayed away. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and a lot of them had their wives out there with them too. Yeah, in some ways it can be very dangerous, but then you're trained to be safety conscious, and it's not like a case that you can nip around the corner to a hospital or to a clinic, get fixed up if you hurt yourself. You're stuck with it on the ship, and there have been cases of operations being done by inexperienced people, being directed over the radio, in extreme cases, and I think in one case it was seen in one of the doctor films, where the doctor at sea, I think it was, where there was an operation done on board at sea for an appendix, I think it was. Yeah, I didn't say at sea all the time. I mixed it, and that's another story. But the last incident that kind of capped it all was when I was involved in delivering tugboats to various places. I got caught by pirates off the coast of Somalia, and that was a pretty hectic 47 days that we were held by them, and something I wouldn't like to repeat again. But we learned a lot of lessons, and it was prevalent in those years. That was in 2008. And 2006, 2007, 2008. Well, now 2013, because of the things that people have learned internationally, and the navies of the world have learned to start to talk to one another, piracy in that part of the world has diminished substantially, because permissions for incursions into other people's countries and to destroy pirate bases and boat building operations that support piracy, they've become more prevalent now, and the navies themselves are having more success at detection. At the end of the day, you catch a pirate, what do you do with them? Recently, the captain that was on my ship, was giving a talk to some, the Women's Institute. That's right, in the UK. And the women jumped the gun and dressed up as pirates and surprised him just as he arrived in the door. And that shows you how people think it's something like an extension of the Pirates of Penzance, but it's not. It's far more serious. And there's big money involved, and the effects upon international shipping is phenomenally expensive. We're talking billions upon billions. The actual money that's paid to the pirates is only a very, very small percentage of the overall cost.
The vessel on which Fred Parle was kidnapped from was captained by Captain Colin Darche. Here's an extract from Captain Colin Darche's book, Capture by Somali Pirates, published by Holt Cottage Press, and a message sent on the 9th of March back in 2008. For 38 days, our lives have had a money value. Without the prospect of money in exchange, our lives and the ship have no value to the pirates. On the 12th of February, we partly escaped for 19 hours. Since then, we've been more closely confined. The cost of keeping us increases daily, with nothing produced locally, all bought from abroad with dollars. The moderates are losing control. Tragedy looms. No more words or delays. You should send a ship with cash, a Somali speaker, an armed guard for self-protection inward to Ras Essir. We will meet you there, tracked by warship. Money transferred by unarmed tender, with us still hostage. Pirates depart for shore. We, with other ship and warship, proceed out of pirate range, then receive 10 tons of water, food for 7 men for 15 days, 2 cases of beer for Dutch employees, and cigarettes for Switzer. Fuel remaining on board, 107 metric tons. This message, uncensored and with approval of 6 crew, well, but worried. Regards, Colin Darche. 11 days later, by the 20th of March, they were to be freed. As listeners may realise at this point, there was very little publicity about this incident at the time. Fred Parle was reluctant to discuss in too much detail until the publication of his memoir on the period, which is steadily taking shape.
I've seen a lot of evidence what the opinions that they hold to support their incursions into piracy, but it doesn't hold any water with me, because all right, the country hasn't had a government for almost 20 years now, and they're trying hard to put some sort of provisional governments together, but they don't seem to work well together. There's a lot of clans involved in Somalia particularly, and they don't see eye to eye, and they're very territorial. So you have a situation where piracy is something that they turn to because they're hungry, and they have to feed their families, and they have to try and send their children to school, and they have to try and keep their health up. Everyone, I think, has seen, or if they haven't seen, the film, what was the name of it, in Mogadishu, Black Hawk Down? Well, if you see that movie, and if you're moved by the violence and everything, that's an everyday situation in the piracy out and off the Somali coast. And not only just the Somali coast, but it's now moved onto off the Nigerian coast. And those Nigerians are a little bit more, they have a lot more cut and trust to them than the Somalis. They do hurt people badly. The Somalis, at least they've got some code of conduct. But they're only after the money in the end, all of them. We're all coloured by the experiences we had and how we were treated. I do believe the few years that I sailed with P&O, I had a standard of living, if you like, on ships that was, it'll never be seen again, I don't believe. We were treated, just for example, as soon as we arrived on board, the first thing that happened was that the agent would come into each of our cabins and fan out a load of membership cards of the clubs for Bombay, Calcutta, Hong Kong, Singapore, Manila, wherever. And you were able to get into any club, free grass and for nothing, and get drinks on the house as well. I mean, that sort of thing, and time to do it, of course. It's slightly different on tankers and bulk carriers and now the high-speed container ships. But in those days, every port that we sailed into with P&O was a wonderful port, because we were so well known, well respected, and let's face it, everybody there was waiting for the cargo that we were carrying. It could be bullion, it could be Johnny Walker Black Label, it could be anything. So this was a wonderful world to operate in, and a good life. Most people in Ireland are insular in some ways, but they live on an island, but they don't really consider it an island. Consider the number of people in Ireland that are not unable to swim. Even consider the number of seamen who proceed to sea that are unable to swim. And I personally feel it's we're missing out on an opportunity with our schooling to make sure that everyone who leaves school can swim. Not only swim, but be able to drive a motor car. And, best of all, be able to stand up in front of a crowd and tell a story or sing a song. It's all character building. And the other is protecting your life.
The remarkable Fred Parle, who, as we mentioned earlier, is working on a book covering his kidnap by Somali pirates 5 years ago. We'll keep you posted here on Seascapes. Next to this tale from the pen of author of Sea Spray and Whiskey, Norman Freeman.
We didn't look forward to mealtimes on our grubby cargo ship. The food was poor. There were a lot of greasy, gristly stews and stringy cuts of meat. More than that, the fare was either undercooked or overdone. This was because our cook, a small, narrow-faced fellow, was drunk a good deal of the time. He staggered around the galley, banging pots and pans, spilling things, cursing. The fried eggs at breakfast were fried solid with singed edges. The bacon was often hard and curled. The chief engineer, who had a deep dislike of the cook, declared one morning, "It takes a chef of particular genius to be able to spoil the simple English breakfast." He invested the word chef with sour sarcasm. It was rumoured that the cook had a secret store of whiskey, rum and brandy hidden in some dark recess in the galley, and that during the small hours he sneaked in and took a bottle back to his cabin. Our voyage took us first to Antwerp, Rotterdam and Hamburg, where we loaded cargo, including many motor vehicles. Even at that early stage, we fled the ship to eat in the little cafes and restaurants around the dock areas, rather than endure the poor fare being served on board. Then we set off for West Africa and eventually reached the hot, humid tropics. We unloaded cargo at Freetown, Conakry, Abidjan, and our final port of discharge, Port Harcourt. We were there for a week or so. The unappetizing food on board drove our fellows to sample some of the local fare. This included highly spiced dishes made from yams that were so hot that mouths and tongues seemed to take fire. After that, we set off for Sapele in Nigeria to load mahogany logs. This port is about 150 kilometres up the winding Benin River. At the entrance, we took a pilot on board, a local man who had tribal scars on his face. The river weaved this way and that, with trees of the tropical forest overhanging the banks. Many on board leaned on the railings to watch the passing scene. Suddenly, the pilot shouted something, and our steersman spun the wheel. Our ship went sideways into the muddy bank. With a whooshing sound, the branches of the big trees arched over our decks. Then a black snake, about 2 metres in length, fell off a branch. It landed on the cook and sank its fangs into his forearm. There was a great hubbub as our fellows killed the snake with brushes and mops and flung its corpse over the side. An ugly swelling developed on the cook's arm and he began to feel acute pain. He was terrified. He was afraid he'd die. As soon as we reached Sapley, he was taken ashore to hospital. The doctors treated him for snake venom and he was kept there for 3 days. When he came back on board, he was a changed man, a different man. Nobody had ever seen him sober before. He had tablets that he was instructed to take daily over the next few weeks. Apparently, he had been warned by the Nigerian doctors that on no account was he to take alcohol of any kind, as it would react with the medication. He certainly took this warning seriously. Not a drop would he touch. He now worked in the galley with sober concentration. Then everybody on board began to notice the very welcome improvement in the way the food was cooked and presented. The dishes tasted better and better with each passing day. However, the chief engineer was unforgiving. He said, "It's a pity he wasn't bitten by a snake at the start of the voyage."
Well, that's it for this edition of Your Maritime Programme. Next week here on Seascapes, we feature a Professor of Marine Conservation at the University of York, Professor Callum Roberts. Callum is the author of Ocean of Life, How Our Seas Are Changing, and he talks to Seascapes about the world's oceans, the prospect of fish farms, and special areas for marine conservation. All that and much more here on Seascapes. So until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.